we'll do whatever we got to do, and then
that sounds good to me.
Yeah, and then we'll talk about the Legion and all that. Oh, wait a minute, we're on. I think we're on. So wait a minute.
I've never read Legion before.
You've never read Legion before.
What is this voice here?
Yeah, who is this?
Hey,
is somebody back?
Yeah, hey, this is Dallas. I haven't been on for quite a long time. So what's up, everybody?
Oh man, it's all great. You know.
I'm back though, and I took over. I actually had to cage fight Al in order to wrestle the host.
And I lost.
Yeah, I picked him over my head.
I lost on purpose.
but so I'm back as host for now. I'm Dallas, and who are you guys?
I'm Dr. Al Morbius.
And I'm Don.
And we're two dimension, even though now we're like three dimension.
We're back to three dimension. Yeah, maybe one day we'll actually have Rook back on the show.
When Rook gets in there, gets to the fourth dimension.
We've got a special, some special holiday episodes planned in the works, so everybody can look forward to that, I guess.
Yeah.
So guys, I have to say, first off, I think you guys have been doing a fantastic job on the show so far. I mean,
thank you.
Just these past few episodes have been really, really good.
Oh,
it's kind of neat also hearing, like, because I haven't been on so long, and then sitting back and watching, listening to you guys. And I went back and listened to some old episodes, and just hearing how far we've come, or as far as like how much better you guys have gotten at podcasting.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of them. We're up to what, 65, 66?
Yeah, this is 65.
Yeah, this is episode 65. Not that anyone's counting though.
Yeah, well, we are. We are, but yeah, I mean, it's a long, strange trip it's been, but it's been fun.
And I like your setup here. You guys are getting a little high tech.
Yeah,
you got this sweet microphone that's like, it's like an ambient mic. I guess it just picks up sound, and we threw it in the middle of the room, and it reminds me of like the Imperial probe droid from The Empire Strikes Back.
Oh, well, that's what it is, exactly. We hijacked
or the one ball from Total Recall. Don and I were talking about that earlier today. Arnold Schwarzenegger sticks something in up his nose. Remember that part?
Oh, that's right.
And then as he's pulling it out, it's like a ball that expanded, and he's got to pull it out of his nostril, and it kind of looks like that.
Did you see the remake of that? Because I didn't.
No, I don't like Colin Farrell, the guy that plays in that movie.
I've
seen him on some talk shows, and he just seems like a complete prick to me. And I could be way off on that. He might actually be a nice guy, for all I know. But I just don't like him. Something about him rubs me wrong. And,
that was odd about the movie, because it didn't seem that long ago. I guess it was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
1990, that was like 23 years
ago. It didn't seem that long ago to me. I thought, well, they're making it already? And you know, one of my students was all excited to see it, and he never saw the original one. So I brought in the DVD and made him watch it.
Did he like it?
He did like it. You know, at the same time, to him, he's the younger guy. If it's past the, 1990 to him is ancient history. But he said it was kind of clunky, but he didn't like the new one that much. And I was kind of happy that it didn't do well. I mean, I don't know that I ever wish bad things on people, but why are you remaking that? Why don't you make... I'm tired of all the remakes,
Yeah, I think the more that fail, I feel like they'll kind of get in their head, oh, we better start experimenting again, and, creating some more original content, some original material, and don't rehash all these old films, which it's nice that they're being inspired by these old movies and they want to do something involved with it. But take that inspiration and create something original. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to play in this sandbox. You can take this inspiration and you can take the lessons you've learned in filmmaking and just in entertainment from all these movies that, you grew up with, and you can create something original and something that a new generation will be able to be inspired upon 20 years down the line.
But it's an easier sell to sell, like, Total Recall, because it's got a name value to it than calling it, like, Cyborgs of the Future.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's
it's got an built-in audience, I guess they figure. But people go by the trailer these days anyway. If the trailer's got a lot of robots or exploding things or whatever, they're gonna go see it.
Well, you hit the nail on the head with the built-in audience, because, I mean, they knew a certain amount of people are going to go see it just based off the nostalgia factor alone, just the fact that it's a Total Recall movie.
They saw it when they were a little kid.
People that are just curious, like, I remember seeing that movie. What did they do to it now, And that's probably the biggest audience that they had.
are
those people.
But, that's one thing about remakes. Everybody complains about it now. I'm always one. But I was just watching The Maltese Falcon. The Humphrey Bogart movie. They had a voiceover, audio commentary. And the guy doing the commentary said that was the third Oh, the Maltese Falcon movies. I never
Sam
did that.
Spade, right? There was.
Yeah, but he said Warner Brothers had it, and the Maltese Falcon was the third one they made of it. But it was the first
one
where they got the template. Different people were in the other ones.
And were they silent, maybe?
It might have been silent, but
yeah, they always did.
I was
did.
Surprised back then. I mean, you know, Maltese Falcon is like this old classic. I never knew that they did that three times.
Wizard of Oz was a silent, too, and then they made it into... I could see that,
well,
because...
Well, Movie for Baghdad was another one.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's a good argument right there. And then, well, here's a for instance. It's not quite a remake, but those Star Wars films that came out a decade ago, the prequels.
The prequels.
You know, people that grew up with those original movies probably specifically didn't like them because they're looking for something different in it. They're trying to see if it'll capture that magic they got in their childhood. You know, it's nothing that's going to be able to happen again, you know,
right,
when you're an adult. But as much as people complain about them, that really, those prequel movies, I'm sure, inspired an entire generation of 5, 6, 7-year-old kids. Right. That was the target market for them. So it, you know, it works. And you were saying about the Maltese Falcon. I'm sure when that movie came out, people remembered that there was a silent version of it, or there was two other versions of it. But, you know, for a whole generation and then generations after that, that third film was the Maltese Falcon to them.
Well, some of those, what you're talking about, silent films, The Thief of Baghdad, the color film was phenomenal with Douglas Fairbanks
Jr.
But they did an old one, a silent movie, a black and white one. I think it was Douglas Fairbanks was in it. And I've seen footage of it. It was incredible. It's really neat. I mean, newer one, it's the one with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. It's one of my favorite movies. It's fantastic. But the old one, it was a different animal, but it was still just as great. But I understand if it's a silent film and you want to make a, you know,
sound. And it can even understand going from black and white to color.
I can do that too.
Because it's such a big leap. And I guess you can say, in a way, you can say, well, Total Recall was made in the 80s, and now the new one's going to have way better effects, and it's going to be like a better-looking movie or whatever. But I think the jump from color to black and white, black and white to color, and the color sounds silent, is a pretty big jump as opposed to smoother
special effects.
Well,
the simple fact going from silent to actual voice
and a different style of acting too.
You had to have a completely different style of acting. Plus, just being able to hear voices and understanding the language so much easier.
Yeah,
that's a huge leap. Like, that's not just putting a new coat of paint on it, per
no,
se. You know,
no.
That's not just adding flash to Total Recall 20 years later.
Mm.
It's still either the same story or not even as good of a story. It might not be as compelling with all that extra flash to it. You know?
Yeah. No, that's true. And then even back then, they had a lot of sequels and stuff like that. Well, it was series. They had, like, The Saint and The Falcon and, you know, the monster ones and all that stuff. But it's like there's been 20 years between these Total Recalls. I guess they figure that's a generation.
It could be, but it's too soon. Yeah. When Total Recall came out, before they showed it, I was watching the cable channel, and I was clicking on the guide. You know, you have a guide on one channel.
Yeah.
And they always have half the screen showing some preview or something, and it was Total Recall, which I never heard of. I'm not a huge Arnold Schwarzenegger fan. I mean, I could take him or leave him. I liked him in Conan.
Yeah.
And to me, I just thought, and I liked him in Terminator, but those are really the only movies I liked. You know, the other ones were fine, but I saw that, oh, it's another Schwarzenegger movie. And then it showed him running through that terminal when he ran in front of the x-ray machine, and it showed a skeleton. What? I was stacked, because that was flawless. And then they showed, you know, real quick, that little trailer, but they were showing these, you know, facts. And my God, that's incredible. Went to see the film. To me, it was an adrenaline rush. And that's all people at work talked about. All kinds of different people. It wasn't just comic book people or science fiction people. And when people talk, it was always breathless. So to me, I always remember that. And of course, I understand it's, what, 23 years ago now? And like I said, my student was saying, I've seen it, it's kind of clunky, you know. Well,
but still, he doesn't have that context to put it in.
Exactly. Special effects aren't going to save a movie.
You're absolutely right. You know. Although I remember being pretty staggered, just like you were. I think I was probably 9 or 10 years old when the movie came out. And I remember seeing that trailer and seeing, I know exactly what you're talking about. Mm. The x-ray machine, and I my jaw dropped too. I was like, that is great. I have to see that movie.
Well, there was one of the receptionists, she was talking to him, she had a little device hitting her nails, and the nails changed color. I think that was Total Recall.
I don't remember.
But there was all kinds of little odd things that you never think about that they had in that film, and to me, they were just neat and they were flawless. And it's just too soon. It was a kind of a special movie.
Well, the one that floored me was Star Wars when I saw the original one. That was like, that's when special effects took that quantum leap for me, you know. So that was kind of like, whoa, you know, this is like, and I wasn't even a little kid. I was like in my, I wasn't that old either. I was like under 20, I think, maybe 19 or 18. But that was a big, like, you know, and I guess it went from clunky old spaceships to, you know, this like, unbelievable, like models that look like they're really in space and the whole nine yards.
Yeah, but at the same time, Star Wars, the first time I saw a science fiction show where a lot of things looked old and dilapidated. The Empire stuff all looked brand new and fresh, but the Rebels and like everything on Tatooine that Luke had, it looked old and used, and I've never seen any movie like that up to that point.
It's definitely a generational thing.
Yeah. Well, those visuals, at least for me, I mean, I'm not a spring chicken, but those visuals I feel still hold up today, though. I mean, they're that good. It's, I think they look a lot better than movies that came out 10, 15 years after them, when digital effects, CG, was still in its infancy. And you saw, you know, those first few years of CG were pretty rough. You watch a movie from, you know, late 80s, early 90s, You see how fake that stuff really looks. I mean, it was astounding at the time, and once again, it's in that context that they're trying something absolutely new, and digital effects hadn't really been done on this scale before.
And the thing, too, is that they actually called it something different. They didn't call it Flash Gordon, which they could have, in a way. They called it Star Wars.
That's what he wanted to do.
He wanted to do Flash Gordon, right?
George Lucas is trying to get the rights to Flash Gordon.
But they called it Star Wars, so that gives it a different feel to it.
Well, the problem was Dino De Laurentiis already had
Flash Gordon.
Because he wanted to do it, and George Lucas couldn't. So George Lucas said, well, I'll write my own.
Yeah. Look at that. And there's an example of what I was talking about earlier. This was because of out of necessity, but instead of taking something existing and remaking it, he took all his inspirations as a
child. That's what I'm talking about, yeah. And look at what happened. Mm. You've got this unbelievable franchise. Just because you didn't make a Total Recall 2, you made a different movie, and all of a sudden it hit a nerve with all sorts of people.
So every generation hereafter, from the, you know, the 70s onward, this is bigger than Flash Gordon.
It's eclipses it. Man, even when you talk to small children, it's always Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
And it's usually, I mean, they like the newer ones, but it's those first three movies.
Yeah,
it's the ones that, it wasn't just the special effects. It was also the acting, the story. And
Yes, exactly.
The other three, there was neat parts to it, but to me it was just so stoic for most of the time.
Yeah, but it's an example of, like, taking something that's kind of the same, not the same as Flash Gordon, but in the same ballpark, and like you said, you really want to do Flash Gordon, changing it, giving it something new, and all of a sudden getting a hit with it, which is what they could have done with the Total Recall thing. Write a new storyline. Maybe you'll get a new franchise out of it.
You know, Nintendo had a game way back in the arcade days they were going to put out. It was Popeye. And they were setting it up. It was basically Popeye, you know, coming in, and Brutus, or Bluto, was the bad guy at the end of the film, or the end of the game. And something came up, and they couldn't get the rights to it. The whole thing dropped out. So they took the game that they already put together, gave their own characters, and it was Donkey Kong.
There you go.
Brutus.
Look how endearing that is.
Bluto was Donkey Kong. Mario was Popeye. And so it became,
I didn't know that
it
either.
Became their own franchise.
That's Mario amazing. And Donkey Kong are just as popular as Popeye, I would say. At least
more so.
I'd say more so, because you can go to Target, you know, Walmart, and find 50 billion expensive ones, cheap ones, bubblegum toys.
That's true.
And Popeye, popular, but in the past, I'm sure it was more, but now, it's a Mario thing. And they make a lot of money off license and everything else, but they took, you know, a concept and made it their own. You never see Donkey Kong or Mario and ever think of Popeye or Bluto.
No, that's true. I never even thought to put the two together, but that makes a lot of
hilarious.
Sense, you know? Yeah, so, I mean, and in comics, you know, there's a lot of reboots going on of characters. They're basically taking old characters, kind of revamping them and changing them to the point, for me anyway, they don't even recognize them anymore. So why don't you, like I said before on this show a million times, why don't you just create new characters?
Yeah, well, DC's doing that with their new 52. They've been doing it, and now they're they're recreating origins for all their villains.
Yeah, they had the villains series.
Yeah, and some of these origins sound a little weak, you know. It seems like there's absolutely no reason to mess with them. If you're gonna go to this much trouble to differentiate these characters from what they used to be, just make something new.
Exactly.
And tell some new stories with some fresh characters, with some fresh faces, something that hasn't been done before.
Exactly.
Well, easier said than done, I know, but my point is, don't take the Joker and give him a brand new origin just because you can, you know.
And that's what they're doing now with these like 3D covers that are painful to the eyes. And now they are.
3D.
Yeah, they had them at Comics World. I saw them. Pat had them. And they were these 3D, but it was like intense 3D where it's like, you know, whatever. But they're already going for like 10, 12 bucks a piece. You know, they did the old short change thing on them or whatever, which is almost like bringing the 90s back again, you know, with like all the gimmicky things or whatever. But apparently they're like popular, man. And he's been selling, he sold out of his original set, or at least, yeah, I think he sold out. And he's got like second printing now, and even they're going for like 10 bucks now.
I never heard of that.
Yeah. They came out 2 weeks ago. It's called Villains. I think it's called like Villains Month, and every issue is going to be like a new. There's going to be a few new titles, but I think mostly it's going to be like a reboot of the origins or whatever. Yeah, and they're going to have like an Earth 3 and all that kind of stuff. So DC's kind of like going back and doing all that like kind of like old school stuff again. Where yeah, we got Crisis, and then well, maybe there is an Earth 3, maybe there is an Earth 2. You know, so I don't know. You know.
Two words: brand management.
Yeah,
that's what
it.
They're doing. They're not. They already, you know, have all the rights to all these other characters. Why create new ones and have more lawsuits?
That's true.
Pay things when you got your own stuff, and it's brand management. They're just trying to protect their brand.
That's been kind of Marvel's thing for a long time too.
Oh,
they would tell
writers,
you know, if you have a new story, don't create any new character because we have so many. Just play in our sandbox. Use what we have. You know,
plus, the writers are like Kirkman are saying, "Why would I create a new character for you when you're just going to take it away from me?"
That's true too.
And like something like Bane or something like that, and
well,
make millions of dollars off it.
I've
and
heard
get,
that too. Yep. I've heard people say it. We saw Chris Claremont at MegaCon, and some guy was talking about, you know, why aren't you writing any comics? And his thing was, when he went in the industry, it was to create new stuff. It was always create new stuff. Now it's just basically take what you got and rearrange it. Well, you know, I mean, I see some guys do really neat stuff with that.
Some
people prefer to do that.
For you know, 15, 20 years, Claremont was doing nothing but creating new characters, a new world.
And doing well, too.
Yeah, like, I mean, he must have created hundreds of mutants and supporting characters over the years. And I mean, I would say probably a good 60, 70, 80% of them are still in use today.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know, but I was going to say that's what you got. Is sometimes you have some people that they like to create new things right and left, and other people, even back in the 60s, there were some cartoonists that didn't like to. They just like to take what you already had and work with it. John Romita was one of those. He didn't like to create. He did create some, but they were always kind of lackluster. But Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, they were just like shooting them all over the place.
Some people have more of a creative spark than others, whereas some other ones are just like just really good artists that don't necessarily want to do anything but just interpret the characters that are there already.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all.
No, not at all.
When I say that, John Romita was fantastic. You know? But I'm just saying that some people, that's what they thrive on. They like to put things out like that, new things.
Most of the ones that you remember the most or the best are usually the guys that created stuff or whatever, you know, regardless of what, you know, even Bob Kane and stuff like that, you know, you always remember him because he's linked with Batman or whatever, you know, you always remember Kirby with the FF Ditko with Spider-Man, even though for legal reasons, whatever goes on or whatever, you know.
Actually, I remember
Bill Finger Jerry created
Robinson.
Joker and all them, yeah. Yeah, all the supporting cast.
Dick Sprang.
Oh, yeah. Dick Sprang did Batman for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, George Perez was talking about something. Did you hear about his
left eye?
His left eye is, like, pretty bad because of diabetes, so he's going to get an operation. But he was basically saying that he doesn't want to work for the big two anymore. He's working for Boom Studios.
I've seen now, he's tried that in the past and gone out and done, you know, his own stuff here and there.
Yeah, he did that cross gen that was over was like coming out of Clearwater here.
Something book.
Well, that was the Crimson Plague. He did two issues, and that was with Image.
Okay.
But it was under their, I think, the Gorilla imprint.
Yeah, they have a few different imprints.
So,
I remember reading that, and it was pretty good. It was dense.
I loved it.
George Perez stuff. I mean, you know, it was thick. There was a ton of characters, a ton of stuff
and
happening.
There was a big plan to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he did one issue, and then whatever, I don't know if that was still Gorilla, but something happened. They went bankrupt, I'm told.
And that wasn't cross-gen?
No, that was Image.
Okay.
I guess they finally did a second issue. I saw the issues far after they were published.
Oh, okay.
But some guy, Melody was telling me all this stuff. Some guy was complaining about it was canceled again. I'm never reading George Perez ever again. Well, it wasn't George Perez's fault. It was the company went out from under him.
Yeah.
But then he went to CrossGen, and of course CrossGen went, yeah, he is doing something with Boom. Right? It hasn't come out yet, has it?
No, but he was saying that he doesn't want to work for the Big Two because he doesn't like... Paraphrasing, he doesn't like what they're doing with the characters that he remembers as a kid, you know? So it's
that's
going to
happen because we've had this conversation time and again. Those are properties.
Yeah.
They're properties, yeah. But they're properties, but whoever's writing them isn't doing maybe what they, you know, they're not, they're changing them to the point of being unrecognizable, which is like a problem with the it's again, we're going to, this will be the generational show, I guess, because it's going to be a problem with generation. They're just revamping it for a new audience.
Yeah, we all have our interpretations of those characters, and those are based on when we started reading them and when we grew up with them, I'm sure, you know.
And they were changed from the Golden Age.
Well, here's an example. I always loved that Batman animated series. It's still, as I talk all the time, it's one of my favorite. That's my favorite Batman. They also did a really nice Superman animated series, which to me was very bright compared to Batman. And at one point, they had the world's finest. It was three episodes of Superman and Batman together. But, you know, Batman was kind of edgy. And my dad was in town. My daughter was fairly small. And we watched it. And when it was over, my dad said, "That's the strangest Superman I've ever seen." And basically what his comment was, it was so dark. Well, like I said, whenever they showed Superman, it was always bright. You know, him and Batman were at odds. You know, they ended up becoming friends, but it was always kind of, you know, there was an edginess to it. And I was just thinking, Dad remembers Superman from the 40s and 50s when he was a kid, and everything was just, you know, bright and over the top.
Yeah, colorful.
Well, when I still see that cartoon, I still see the brightness and optimism of Superman. But it was more of my generation.
Right.
And my dad, like I said, it was a big thing. He didn't complain or anything, but, yeah, it is right. I mean, kids growing up now, they're not reading the new DC, but, you know, I guess if they grow up with it, that's what you know, that's okay. But.
And, well, here's an example of just between your generation and my generation. Don, growing up with the X-Men, you know, your ideal vision of the X-Men is the Cochran group, I'm pretty sure.
And the Byrne.
And the Byrne. Yeah. I grew up with, you know, the Mark Silvestri era. So the X-Men to me, that's Dazzler, that's Longshot, Havoc, right. Colossus.
And mine is the original ones.
And you got
mine is the original, Kirby. the five guys, gals. We just finished doing a Five Guys anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And so that interpretation just depends on when you started to read them and when you enjoyed them the most. Now, to Claremont's credit, maybe to Byrne's credit, going back and reading the older stuff, I'd probably agree with you that definitive version, in my eye, is also probably the John Byrne team, the Paul Smith team, also maybe with Rogue. But that's not what I grew up with, and that's not initially how I see the X-Men.
Well, it's funny, because I read X-Men, and about the time I stopped was when, I think it was the Marauders showed up.
That's when I started.
Yeah, I thought that was funny, because that's when Dallas started picking up and reading it. And, at the same time, it's rare to follow a book all the way through. It was Sergio Arguinez one time was saying that he sees letters to comic books or Mad Magazine, which I've been reading Mad since the very inception, you know, for like 20, 30, 40 years. And they're complaining about what they did. And his comment was, that's really sad. That's really sad that you don't move on. Well, I when saying that, I've always read Gru. You know, I mean, he's done Gru from 1981. and I still pick it up and enjoy it. But that's one of the few books that I've continued to read. A lot of times you'll read it for a while and really love it, and then at one point, okay, I've seen enough, and you go on.
But that's also the same writer, the same artist,
yes.
The same inker, the same creative team. You know, that's Aragonés and Mark Evanier.
Yeah. But,
so that's a little different from the X-Men or the Legion of Superheroes, where it's always changing.
But there's something reassuring about going back in a comic book and kind of having it seem sort of like what it was before. When it gets a little too different, it just kind of like throws you for a loop, you know what I mean? And then there is something good about reading or watching something and getting that reassuring feeling, whether it's nostalgia or something else.
You're absolutely right. That's the thing I was thinking about was, remember that TV show, The A-Team? I guess you
remember Yeah. Remember The A-Team?
I watched it.
I never saw it. I was in boot camp and some guys were talking about they watched it all the time. And I was surprised Mr. T would be on a TV show, because when Mr. T first came out in Rocky, he was terrifying.
Well, he was a bouncer for Muhammad Ali?
Well,
or a bodyguard?
He was a bouncer. He came on David Letterman one night when David Letterman was still on NBC. This is in 1982.
Yeah.
And it was unnerving. He was scary. He was intense. And I was scared to death of the man. I saw, the previews to Rocky III, and he was terrifying on that. And I said, my God, who is this guy? Well, to tell the story, he was bumped. He was supposed to be on one night, and they had two stupid pet tricks. It lasted too long, and they bumped him. He came in the next night, and, David Letterman was being himself. And at one point, Mr. T was saying things about, my hair is not a mohawk. He says, it's an African tribe, and that's where they wear their hair, and he did it, which, okay. And the feather earrings was another one. And he was going on about all the gold. He says he invested his money in gold, and he invested in gold chains, because chains were what the white man used to keep his people down. So it's a reminder to the white man that he's successful, and you put him in chains, and now he makes his own. But he was saying it very, my God, who is this guy? And at one point, David Letterman made some quirk, and then he goes, you notice I'm holding a rubber ball. Every time you tell one of those corny jokes, I squeeze this ball. When it gets up to 8, and he just stopped. And I'm like, I'm in Oklahoma watching this. I'm like, oh my God.
You're scared for Letterman's life.
Yeah, Letterman kind of stopped talking after a while. And finally, at one point, something was said. And he was going on about, my time's important. And he says, I don't appreciate my time being wasted. So when he came on the show and he was bumped, and then Dave Letterman said something about stupid pet tricks. And anyway, at one point, Dave Letterman leaned in. How many times did you squeeze that ball, Mr. T? But like I said, he was intense. He was explaining about how they discovered him on NBC's The World's Toughest Bodyguard. And he was talking about some people can't afford protection and needs it. So he steps in and helps out. He was interesting. And, but like I said, he was terrifying. And as a matter of fact, the next night, Joe Piscopo came on the show. And he even said, I was backstage and I saw Mr. T there and you bumped him. Who told him he couldn't come on? And then David Letterman's like, waved him off, like, don't even talk about it, So imagine my shock when I'm in the Navy and my brother's watching A-Team. I watched it with him and I thought, who is this? This isn't Mr. T that I saw. He was like a big teddy bear, But anyway, my brother's walking me through the show, because at one point they're building something, at one point in the episode, and my brother says, oh, they always build something at this point, really? And then he said, one of the teachers at the school, her and her sons watched it, and he said, one episode they didn't build anything, and the kids looked and said, but Mom, they didn't build anything. And he was saying every episode was the same, it was the same framework, and it never appeared. Well, my daughter was little, she used to watch the Power Rangers, Mm-hmm. And it's basically the same episode, And this one mother at the school was talking about it and says, yeah, people say it's the same episode. It says, but it's familiarity, and I think small children need that. Well, it's true. You like familiarity. Newspaper comic strips. No matter what kind of stuff you read in the news, it's horrifying. You can always count on reading Dennis the Menace and the Family Circus and all the stuff. And
the funnies.
And, it's kind of familiar. It's the same. It's your security blanket when you're a little kid.
Exactly.
So, Yeah, it's the illusion of change in brand management.
Well, when you mentioned WrestleMania, when you mentioned Mr. T, I got to tell you something, because when I did Slow Robot a few months ago, we did one of our episodes was, instead of a movie, we did WrestleMania 1. We reviewed it. And Mr. T's in WrestleMania 1. Yeah. He wrestles with like an attack team. I don't know if Hulk Hogan's in there or not. He was the smallest guy in the place. He could hold his own, though. He was lifting people up and doing all the moves, but he was the smallest guy in the joint. So it was kind of funny to see this guy, which you remember being on TV, and it's like, larger than life. And in actuality, he was maybe average height. At least that's what it looked like. The other guys could have been giants or whatever for
his
all
personality
I know.
Helped, too, I think. Oh, that made him larger than life.
He had a massive personality. He was really interesting. But
yeah, well, a similar thing happened to me in a different way is they remade that A-Team, and here's a remake I actually liked. And this is a few years back, they remade it, and the guy that played Mr. T was Rampage Jackson, and he used to be a UFC heavyweight fighter. He was a champion for a long time. I remember him beating Chuck Liddell, and it was huge. This was years ago. And at that time, that was how I was introduced to Rampage, is this badass UFC fighter that just came in and knocked the king off his crown, you know, and this guy was unstoppable for a while. And then I saw him as B.A. Baraka in the A-Team, and I'm like, he is like a teddy bear, just like you saw Mr. T in the A-Team TV show. It was very funny.
You know, it's the thing, just because you're a good fighter doesn't mean, you know, Mr. T loved kids. Oh, well, you know, it's the future of the human race.
He was in Hostess Twinkies ads in the comics in the 70s.
Yeah, but it's what he turned into from what he showed. I mean, when I saw him on that, I still think, you know, yeah, everybody likes kids. Even Hitler likes small kids, you know, as we talked about last
true.
Episode. But,
some small kids.
Yeah, well. But no, it was funny. I didn't know they remade the A-Team.
Yeah, it was with, what's his name?
It was a TV series?
No, it was just a movie.
Oh.
It had a...
Theatrical or television?
Theatrical. Yeah, it was a big budget. It was a big budget film. It was what the hell's the name of the guy from The Hangover?
The Hangover.
Rook's got to help me here. But
I know the movie. I never saw it, but there was a movie.
Oh, okay.
I think
there was a movie.
It had a few big-name actors in...
we'll look it up.
It had a few big-name actors in the A-Team movie, though.
But it wasn't a big hit.
No, I don't think
medium,
so. Don't
medium size.
That's what they all are when they do these. How many times have you ever heard them remaking the TV show and it was a big hit?
There was a lot of hype, but it was one of those movies, just like Total Recall, blink and you would have missed it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and then you find it a cutout rack at the discount store, you know.
I miss those cutout racks at the discount store.
Yeah,
What stores are there besides Walmart and Target?
Oh, yeah, but they you get DVDs for $5. Good ones.
Yeah, sometimes you do. I mean, that's a whole different show that we did. Hey, let's take a break. We're at the halfway point. So,
all right.
Dallas, what are you going to play? Music? You got anything?
Yeah, I'm going to throw out a little music. How about we listen to some Cold War Kids?
There you go.
All my windows were barred. The sun made stripes of shade. I was sitting around like a zombie, feeding my own face. I was counting my sheep. I was digging my strange. I was taking you for granted. You were holding the reins. But I can hear you louder than ever. Whisper. Every
ever. Those Cold War kids. I don't know what song because I haven't chosen it yet. But it's a great little indie band. They've been around for a little while. They have, you know, a good 4 or 5 albums. An old buddy of mine got me into them years ago. And they've definitely changed their sound. It's just evolved over the past few years. And he can't stand it anymore. You know, he doesn't like their newer stuff, but I'm really digging it. Their new stuff's great, and that song was one of their newer songs.
Well, when did they start? When did the band first appear? Do you know?
Probably early 2000s.
Okay, so they've been around about 13 years.
Probably, oh. Yeah. I mean, don't quote me on that.
Never heard of them.
They're local.
No.
Okay.
Pretty popular indie band, and they just got bigger. They've played on, I want to say, Letterman? One of those shows.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're doing music, aren't you? What are you doing these days musically? Anything?
Musically? Yeah.
What's the name of your band, sir?
We don't know this. Yet.
They're changing it.
We're up in the air. We had tried to throw around a couple names, and we've been calling ourselves Dungeon Boss for a while, and we've gotten completely negative reaction from everyone. No one seems to like it.
I didn't like it.
We're already getting sick of it. Oh, my wife hates it. Mm. But, you know, and we kind of... Brent brought up a good point. We have a song named Dungeon Boss. That's where we got the idea. And he feels it might come off as a little gimmicky that we're naming the band that. And that's all just perspective, you know. We're not going for a specific gimmick, so it's really not.
You're not going for the goth bondage crowd?
No, it pertains to video games.
Yeah,
that's what Ellie thought, I think, at first.
First, when you said Dungeon Boss, I thought, that's a weird game. And then you were basically, it was the video game thing, going to Mario and the Dungeon.
Yeah, that's it too. Yeah.
That's the context that we named the band in.
Yeah, I was going to say, it could be like D&D or Dungeons and Dragons.
So if Nintendo did license Popeye, what would you have called the band? Because it wouldn't be a dungeon. It would be Ship's Hold.
We'd be calling it the Ship's Hold, the Sea Hag. We're going to name our band the Sea Hag.
Well, Ship's Hold, because Brutus always had a hole that he kept all the stuff in.
Well, how about like Stretch Marks Brothers? you know what I'm talking about. That's from Stevie, right?
Yeah, that huge list.
Yeah, I got an email, and I just keep looking through the email, and I see all these band names.
Yeah, there's some funny ones in there.
He's crazy, that guy, man.
So I don't know what we're going to call ourselves. We still get together just once a week. I mean, all of us have families, and some of us have kids, so it's really hard for us to, you know, practice more than a couple hours a week.
Hmm.
We still get together. We're writing music. Over the years, we've written 100 songs probably, you know. But we've got, you know, probably a dozen that we're serious about that we've been practicing. We picked up a new recording program that we've been playing around with.
Pro Tools?
FL Studio, it's called. Okay. Which probably, from my understanding, it's not the most ideal for live recordings. But I've been working with it. Got a keyboard with some MIDI sounds on it. And we've just been playing around, trying to create some beautiful, awesome music. But nothing's come of it yet, but, you know, hopefully soon.
Well, yeah, so we like to play some on the show.
Yeah, and we also plan on playing some concerts, some shows here soon. And I'm trying to talk everybody into playing down this way, the St. Pete area, where our fan base really is.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
definitely.
Well, I've got a song Dallas's band did before Brent joined them, which I love. I play it in the car all the time, and he won't let me play it. Thank you very much, Mr. Dallas Boucher.
You may be the only person that actually wants to hear that, though.
It's an awesome song.
Yeah.
All our thousands of fans out there may want to hear it. And so, you know, the public is out there waiting for your music, so...
All right, well, interesting, but gentlemen, this is a comic book podcast, and we're here to talk
about movies.
Let's talk comics. What do you got, boys? What do you got? Give me something.
Legion of Superheroes. Let's talk about the Legion of Superheroes.
Here I am. I've never really read the Legion before. I know a bit about them, and I obviously know what they are, who they are. You know, they're very famous, very you know, inspirational. But never really read any Legion of Superheroes books. Els, let me read this really neat magazine that's talking all about the history of the Legion and whatnot. And just thumbing through it, man, some writers, some artists have worked on this book, man.
Well, it's kind of like Don and I were talking about it. It's one of the first teenage superhero comic books that I can think of, unless there's something in the Golden Age that I was missing. It's before the Teen Titans. So, I mean, that's it's a first of its kind. And it was always a backup strip, at least in the beginning.
But the way I found them, Superboy in the 70s had a backup strip. It was always a Legion of Superheroes. And it caught me. But, I mean, honestly, I can't think of a more dorky idea in the planet. But, you know, when you're 9 years old, it's really neat. But it was a team of teenage superheroes in the 30th century. Superboy from the 1950s and 60s would fly into the 30th century and join them. But they had strict rules. You had to be a teenager. You had to have a superpower that no one else in the Legion had. And, you know, you basically applied at the Legion. They had auditions. And people always make fun of it, talking about it was super peer pressure, you know. But it was silly, but they were just great fun. And the Legion got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I would see them in old reprints in the back of Superboy, and sometimes they even buy old issues. I started out in Action Comics, I think, in the late 50s. The whole idea was there was a girl from one of Saturn's moons, a guy from some planet that I've never heard of, and another guy from Earth. And they got on some space transport, like an airplane, and they were going somewhere. I guess there was, you know, space jackers on the plane, and they stopped him. Well, the richest man in the universe found this, brought him in the office, and wanted to bankroll him as a superhero team. And they were saying, we're just kids. And then he showed him a historical video of Superboy and Supergirl. It says, they fought crime as kids, the same age as you. So that was the birth of it. And then, you know, like I said, the Legion just kept getting bigger and bigger. And there were times where somebody had a duplicate power and couldn't join them. But I think they must have had 40, 50 people in it when I was reading them in high school.
This is in the early 70s.
Yeah.
Because before it was only like, what, like five or ten maybe or something like that in the 60s?
It depends, because I'd find old issues of Superboy, you know, or Action. And I was reading where Phantom Girl showed up, you know, Invisible Kid showed up, and, you know, the Legion just kept getting bigger and bigger. But like I said, it was in 1971 or 72 when I was reading these reprints in the back. And it was towards the end of 71 where they had a new one called the New Tale of the Legion of Superheroes. First, I was a little taken aback. I didn't care for it very much. They changed Saturn Girl's costume. You know, she was wearing a pink bikini, which I like now, but, you know, 9 years old or 10 years old, not really.
What is this crap?
Well, you know, I thought, this isn't them. But I did start liking the art, but it was Dave Cockrum. Kerry Bates wrote the stories, and Dave Cockrum, who I'd never heard of, was drawing them, and Murphy Anderson was inking them.
Let me just say, I've heard a lot about Kerry Bates. You know, I've read some of his older stuff here and there. Yeah. Saw a picture of him in this magazine. He was a real hippie, man.
Yeah,
a lot of the guys were hippies. I mean, if you read the, remember in the Marvel Comics books, the Untold Story, boy, talk about hippies.
Oh, man. Especially Jim Starlin and his crew.
His crew, exactly. Yeah,
you know, it is one thing we're talking about, how the comics was a closed shop. It was all these guys from the,
it was up until the 70s.
Yeah, in the 70s. I remember Marty Pascal, Walt Simonson, Bernie Rice, all these guys came in.
Yep, it was.
You always hear about how they, you know, these older cartoonists have said, you know what the problem with you is? When I'm doing artwork, I look at Michelangelo and try to recreate it. So you guys are looking at this crap.
Frazetta.
Yeah, you know, it's like you're basically just recycling, you know, crap, which is, all my life, that's what I've heard is criticisms about, you know, a lot of cartoonists just look at other comic books instead of looking at real life. But it was more than that. I mean, you got these guys from the World War II generation and before, and then you have all these kids coming in, you know, psychedelic and, you know.
Well, you got the first generation of fans coming in.
Yeah, it was
doing the comic books. Because if I remember correctly, in the 60s, there was very few artists that broke in. Maybe Jim Aparo, maybe Neil Adams, maybe Steranko.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a few guys for Charlton, but there wasn't that many people breaking into the big two. By like 69, 70, you saw the floodgates open. A lot of young guys.
And a lot of them that were getting in weren't from outside of the industry. They had connections, other than maybe Steranko, who just kind of forced his way in and by showing off.
A lot of them were the fanzine artists. Fanzine started in the early 70s, and they were basically like, you know, you want to show your art? Okay, here, fanzines were like, you know, sold in, you know, I don't know where they sold. Maybe in conventions. They were sold in conventions.
Stuff, probably, right?
Yeah, they're mostly conventions because that was where the fans hung out. So then they would get a reputation at a convention as being like a big shot. And then like when the convention started becoming bigger, then more of the writers and editors from the big two or whatever would show up. And then people like Wrightson, Jones, Kaluta, Chaikin, Starlin, Alan Weiss, and all them got gigs in the majors because of Englehart.
Well, Cochran was another one.
Cochran was another one. He was from that era.
He did all the fanzine work as well. Mm-hmm.
He did the fanzine work. He was, before you had the old pros that were basically like a lot of them from looking at the old Golden Age comics that I do in my blog. A lot of them, these guys, like people like Gil Kane, started Golden Age. They started in the 40s.
Kubert,
everybody. Kirby, Toth, everybody. But by the 60s and 70s, that's when their styles got, perfected.
They had
honed
their craft for 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Their craft was just...
Yeah, they were pretty...
Diluted to this pure essence of, what they could do. And yeah, look at Kirby's early work in the 40s with Joe Simon. And then you look at his Stan Lee stuff, and wow, blows your mind.
Yeah. I mean, Kirby always had the crude energy, but yeah, it was a little bit different. But those guys were from the war generation. Those guys ruled from like the 40s all up until the 60s. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, new guys came in, and the old guys still had it. But in the 80s, they started tearing because by that point, they probably got in their 70s, maybe a little older. So then the floodgates open. Now it's just... Totally new guys.
Some
now.
Of those guys, even in the late 70s, I thought were already tired.
Yeah.
They just got tired and boring.
They were just doing the same old poses that they did a million times before. No, we're not going to name names, but you guys know who they are.
The same writers the same way. And I even heard one guy talking about, I guess he's, I can't think of his name. He's writing Spider-Man now. He used to write the Ren and Stimpy comic book.
Chris Felucci? John Chris Felucci?
He's writing.
Bob Camp?
No.
I can't remember.
He's a writer. He's a writer in comic books.
Okay, anyway.
Anyway, but he was talking about what you got to do. The problem is, if you ever read those old licensed product stuff in the 70s, and sometimes even the 60s, basically these guys had a generic story. And whenever they say, I need you to write this for, say, whatever comic book, they just pull out the story that they wrote for, like, Tom and Jerry in the 50s, and they play it for, say, whatever's popular, in the 70s and 80s. And it wasn't really part of the character or anything. It was just these generic stories. And he says what you have to do is completely immerse yourself into their world, and which is what he did with the Ren and Stimpy comic. The Simpsons comics that Bongo puts out, same thing. Those some of the guys like Len Wein, Sergio Gonzalez, they do stories for it. But it has a Simpsons feel. It has a Simpsons voice. And that Adventure Time cartoon that's out now, it's so popular. Their comics is the same way. It feels like the show. It's unique. It's their own stuff. But they're unique to it. But before, you'd buy a comic of, Huckleberry Hound or something, and it was nothing like the cartoon. It was just some generic story.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
And that's what a lot of those guys were doing by, the time I was growing up was, I'd read old reprints of the 60s stuff and 50s, and wow, this is great. And you'd read stuff they were doing, what they call the Bronze Age, and it was tired and uninspired.
Well,
with some exceptions. But Bill Kubert was never that way.
But again, we're getting back to the reassurance thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it might have been cold and uninspired because you were a young guy or whatever, but now if you go back and read that stuff, you might kind of feel like, oh, it's like the old books that I read. Maybe they weren't the greatest written things in the world, but it kind of brings me back to like a good time.
Yeah, is a lot of that just nostalgia?
Yeah, a lot of it is nostalgia.
Rose-colored glasses.
Somebody was writing about Jack Kirby, and we all read that book about, when Jack Kirby came back to Marvel, that some of the staff people were making fun of the books he wrote.
Yeah.
Saying that, I bought them.
Me too.
But when I did buy them, like I said, Black Panther, one of my favorite characters in the world, and I loved it when Jack Kirby did him. But when he did the Black Panther book along Captain America, when he came back to Marvel, I'd buy it and look through it. Why am I buying this? I would just kind of, it's like you say you buy a record album and it just goes in one ear and out the other. That's what these comics are doing. Mm. There was elements to it. I wanted to get it. But somebody was posting on Facebook about, they were posting splash pages from the Black Panther. And I look at them and I find them staggering and imaginative. And he said, you know, he remembered when he was buying them back in the 70s. He says, people were saying bad Kirby, you know, and his time is over. He says, but looking at an age without Kirby, it's just nothing but gold. Well, if you compare it to his early Marvel stuff, or even the Fourth World stuff, maybe it's not as good, but it's still good. It's what Al's pointing out. And you're right, sometimes it is fun to find these old stories.
Yeah, well, the same thing with music. Sometimes you might remember an old Stones album, and there was a song that you go, wow, this wasn't Brown Sugar, this wasn't Can You Hear Me Knockin', this wasn't this and that. It was just a song on that record, and you hear it now, and you go, damn, you know, that was a decent song. It was so overwhelmed by the other goodness there that I never gave it a chance. And that's what's happening with us, or at least with me anyway. I go back and I see some little gem that I didn't like notice back then. I'm going like, well, you know what? I got to say, that was actually pretty good.
I'm continually noticing that going through those old Chris Claremont Uncanny X-Men's. I'm trying to get through the whole run. And I'll come across issues that I had read in the past, and I just glossed over them. And realizing they're, you know, some of them are pretty brilliant. I mean, there's some great art. There's some great writing in there. And, you know, when I was younger, or even up to just a few years ago, I'd read through these books and think nothing of it. Didn't think they were special in any way, but now going back and seeing some of these, wow, you know, how did I miss this?
That is true.
But yeah, the Legion, I mean, I'm not going to say it's one of the first fan-oriented book, but it did have a fanzine built around it called Legion Outposts.
Yeah.
And even though there were fanzines in the 60s, they were pretty much mimeographed things. In the 70s, they got a little bit better. And a lot of it, and Cochran was a fan artist who worked his way up from fanzines to the professionals or whatever. So it had a different feel, you know, to it or whatever. And it was kind of like, in a way, it was kind of knocking the old fogies out a little bit. And the younger kids got into it, you know what I mean?
Well, he put everything into it. And it was funny because I remember buying back Superboy issues. Bob Brown and Murphy Anderson did the lead story, which I did like very
well.
But then he always had this, you know, 10 to 12 page Legion backup, and when Cochran started inking himself, those stories were just staggering to me. And I kept seeing all these characters I knew from old reprints, and most of them had new costumes. And it was all done in 73, 74. They looked like people from 73 and 74. You know, it didn't look like your dad's old superheroes. The stories were neat. They were going all over the place. It was like even on the short, you know, page size. So much has happened. They're going all over the places. All these fantastic things were happening. New characters are popping up right and left. And after about three or four issues of it, it changed from Superboy to Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. And, you know, Cochran was doing the whole issue.
Yeah.
It didn't last long. There's not a lot of them. I guess it was maybe a year and a half. And then he left. And
I think they showed in there was an issue that Cochran drew in Grell ink, and then it went after, and from then it went to Grell.
What happened was it was Superboy and Legion of Superheroes 202, which is one of those 100-page super spectaculars I love.
Which were great.
It was awesome. But what they did was they had a lead story and a backup story. Well, in this oversized issue, what they did is they put the backup story first, and it was drawn by Dave Cochran. But Mike Grell inked it, and that was a test. When Mike Grell went to get the job, Dave Cochran had left. And I can't remember who the editor was. I want to say it was Julius Swartz, but whoever it was, he said to
was
Mike
it Bradwell?
Grell, but he just said, what the hell makes you think you can draw comics? Mike Grell opened up his portfolio and showed him. So he gave him that Legion of Superhero backup. And I said, well, this guy's going to try inking that. So he inked it, did real well. So 202 started with that backup strip, then it had a couple of reprints. Then it had the main strip, which had the Devilfish, which, you know, Cochran did the whole thing, and to me it was just staggering. And then it had a three-issue reprint that I think Kurt Swan drew it. I think Jim Shooter wrote it. It's one of my favorite stories.
I remember that, the one where they're like slaves or something on a planet or whatever.
You're put
I
on
remember
a prison
that.
Planet. There's there's a couple other superheroes. I guess the guy was imprisoning teenage superheroes.
Yeah.
And the girls are in a separate camp. I got to tell you, my favorite thing, one of the favorite things in my life, my family moved to Oklahoma for a temporary time when I was four. And we were new there, and we have to go to this laundromat by the park. And, you know, as a kid, you just get bored, you know. There's just nothing but fishing magazines and ladies' magazines. And they had a comic book. And my dad read me the comic book.
Oh, that's cool.
And it was that story. And I don't understand why, but there's all these characters that had superpowers. They're all teenagers, like my uncles and aunts. I just thought it was incredible. And the only thing I can remember about it was the guy with the three eyes that was bad to everybody. And one guy could eat through a rock. And Dad said he's the eater because he can eat through things. So, you know, when I'm nine, I wonder what the comic book was. You know, it didn't make any sense. And when I was 12 and I got this Legion of Superheroes 202, I realized it was Matter Eater Lad, you know, from the Legion of Superheroes. That's one of my favorite stories.
His name's Matter Eater Lad?
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. He came from a planet where, I guess, people were starving, so they developed where they can eat anything. But it's a silly superpower, but he could eat anything. Steel, glass, metal, you know.
Yeah.
Does it feel weird saying the names out loud? Because, like, I can see that. That would look fine on paper. That's great. You can read it and think, oh, no big deal. But when you say it out loud, like when you said Mad Reader Lad.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, they say that about it, comic book dialogue. You know, they're watching the movie. They sit down, I think it was Alan Moore, somebody said you can't read the dialogue out loud or it sounds stupid. But when you read
On lyrics, too, music lyrics, sometimes they don't sound good when you read them out loud.
Yeah, because they're not, and that's the thing, they're not meant to be, music lyrics aren't meant to be read, they're meant to be sung in the context of the music. Comic book dialogue, even current dialogue, which is generally a little better, more realistic per se, even that's not meant to be read aloud. It's meant to be seen on paper and read in your head, looked at in the context of the pictures and the story that's going along.
Exactly.
But that's anyway, that was Cochran's last issue, and after that Mike Grill took over the drawing chores.
And why did Cochran leave?
Well, that's the funny thing. It was abrupt. And he went over to Marvel, but the reason was there was two characters, and you'll laugh at this. It was a wedding between Dual Damsel. Dual Damsel was a woman that could split herself into two people. Well, originally, she was Triplicate Girl. She could split into three different women. That's what the people on her planet could do. So it was three separate people. But one of her bodies was killed, so she became Dual Damsel. And she married, wait for it, Bouncing Boy.
Bouncing Boy, yeah.
Bouncing Boy was a fat guy that could inflate himself and turn into a, you know, almost like a rubber ball and bounce around. It was silly. But what's funny was,
I love Legion already, and I've never even read it.
And he always talked about that, like, what a dorky character. And when Dave Crockett was drawing it, he was the main character in it, but they always talked about he was the sorriest excuse for Legionnaire. Well, what happens, he lost his powers. Oh, there's other thing, you can't be married in the Legion. And he asked Dual Damsel to marry him. And this is, anyway, they had a big wedding issue, and they went to Mars. Yeah.
That's Bouncing Boy, yeah.
I looked through the magazine. But, anyway, in this wedding, there was a two-page spread on the issue, and it's incredible. But it shows this priest, and, you know, they're getting married. And they have a key, index in the back telling who everybody is.
Yeah, like it's kind of like a Sergeant Pepper's kind of thing.
Exactly.
It's all these things.
But Mars Tarkas and John Carter, Warlord of Mars, is in the audience.
Oh, I love
because
that.
They get married in Mars. And
it's
also,
like something they would do in that top 10 book.
Exactly.
They,
and John Jones is way off in the background because he was from Mars. So there were some jokes that Dave Cochran put in, but the double page spread was staggering.
Yeah, that's all the characters.
Basically, Dave Cochran wanted it back. He asked if he could get the artwork back. And I said, yeah, sure, I don't see any problem for those two pages. That's all he wanted. And I can't remember who it was. Somebody else went in office. He can't have that. And that was it. And he said, no, he won't return it. And Cochran got mad and walked out, went over to Marvel and Marvel. But I'm also told he was already kind of planning things, looking at Marvel before. But that's when he walked out. He had a lot of plans. Storm, Nightcrawler, and Colossus were all going to be in the Legion strip. I don't think they were going to be an actual Legion of Superheroes. I think there was a spinoff comic that they were planning. But Storm was like kind a leader of one of them.
Kind of like Kirby with the FF holding on to characters until he got to DC.
Cockrum, I feel, was kind of like Kirby in that respect. He was just a creation generator. He was a machine that just... all these characters, almost like they sprung fully formed out of his imagination.
Exactly.
He was just shooting, knocking them out, man.
There was one website I read where the guy said Dave Cockrum was the greatest character designer with the exception of Jack Kirby. Well, I told a friend of mine that who loved Dave Cockrum, but he said, well, that's actually kind of a broad overstatement. Well, I feel that way. I feel that after Jack Kirby, it's Dave Cockrum. But there's a lot of people, I guess, that did create a lot of strips. But to me, Dave Cockrum is the next one.
Yeah, you can't argue his merit and how important he was. And as much as I make fun of the guy, just because I personally don't like his art style, you know, I'm in awe of what he's done, and I respect and appreciate everything he's done.
But
he's
Marvel,
very influential.
His Marvel work was good, but that Legion of Superheroes work, to me, that's still my favorite. And it's staggering when I see him, what he did with it. But anyway, the Legion went on to other people. I read the Mike Grell stuff. I loved it when I was in high school, but it's one of those things where as I got older, I don't care for it.
I never liked his art.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of these. It's my case. When I got older, I didn't like it. I see why I liked it then.
Yeah.
But it went to different artists here and there. I remember
Jim Sherman did some.
Mike Nasser did a little
Mike
bit.
Mike Nasser did some, yeah.
And Keith Geffen came on. I never read these, but Keith Geffen came on. And
he had like a... Keith Geffen back then had a more like a traditional superhero... Yeah. And he did that poster. I think Pat's got it in his store where he does all the
Legionnaires. I never read those. I think the book was actually getting really popular.
I think it was, yeah.
It was Keith Geffen, and I think Paul Levitz is still writing it.
Early 80s maybe, mid-80s or something, yeah.
There was a point in 1984, I think, I bought an issue of the Legion because they had the Fatal Five, the bad guys, on it. And I liked the cover, and it was Carl Kiesel inked it, and I'm trying to think of that guy's name that drew it. It was terrific, but he did two issues.
I was just going to say.
And those issues were incredible. The closest thing I think of is like watching Star Wars in a comic book. It was about the Legion of Superheroes. There was a character I read when I was a kid called Devin, which was another guy from Krypton. He had Superboy's powers. But on Krypton, he was a teenage thief.
Man, how many people survived that?
Yeah, well, that's why they did Crisis. But anyway, in this 1984 issue, Devin came back. And I just read one page, but it kind of shocked me because it wasn't like the typical Superman strip or superpower guy where he just walks in and busts through. There was a guard outside this kind of fortress dressed in fur and armor. And he flies behind him. And then he just sucks all the air, you know, with a super breath, and the guy passes out. And then he just takes on his own, you know, the fur and the armor, puts it on, uses some little inducer and changes his appearance and walks into thing. He was using stealth, even though I guess he could have. And I'm reading this, Paul Levitz wrote it. Well, that's really neat. And there was all kinds of stuff through that. I bought the second issue, same creative team. I thought, this is incredible. Well, then they were gone. And it was other people drew it. So like I said, there's two issues I picked up. Once in a while, I'd pick an issue up somebody. I think a guy named Steve Lytle or something.
Steve Lytle, I remember him. He was a good artist.
Yeah.
That's who that guy is.
I know him from Classic X-Men, that run of comics that reprinted the old Cockrum Byrne.
Really?
Claremont. Steve Lytle did covers sometimes.
That's right.
With Art Adams
that's
and a few other artists that I saw for the first time there.
That's right.
And that's all I've ever known Steve Lytle from is the covers of old
He did a lot of covers, and not, more so than he did interior art. He was always a good artist.
Well, he worked on the Legion for a while, but I'd randomly pick an issue up. Like I said, I liked him. I didn't read it again until in the early 90s, they did a comic book called Legionnaires.
I remember.
What was the guy? Chris Sprouse drew it.
He's a good artist.
Oh, it was terrific.
Chris Sprouse. Is he the guy that did Tom Strong?
Yeah, Tom Strong.
Oh, he's a fantastic artist.
He's still doing Tom Strong. It's back again.
But that, it was a handful of issues. But basically, and this, I didn't know what was going on. But it was a clones of the Legion of Superheroes. Because I guess basically it was like something happened on the planet, and the planet Earth was almost destroyed, and you know, it was an apocalypse type thing. And the Legion of Superheroes were all these sullen adults. You know, the whole dark comics history thing. This is in, I guess, 92. And they're trying to put the planet back together. And they kept talking about these kids. Well, the kids ended up being clones. I don't know how they found them. It was in a Legion of Superheroes book that I bought. But another artist drew the first half of the book. And the Chameleon Boy, who could change shape, he had antennas. When I was a kid, I loved him. He decided to, you know, step in and help these kids out. And it was the young versions of the Legion. But there was, instead of Supergirl, there was another girl named Aura or something.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just greatness. I read it and really enjoyed it. And then they had their own book called Legionnaires. And I think about 10 issues, Chris Sprouse drew it. And then another artist came in and took over. It was Adam Hughes.
Another great artist.
He did several issues. And they brought the Devilfish back, you know, for the Cochran run. I loved it, but I mean, it had the feel for the old 60s Legion, 50s and 60s, but they kind of updated the costumes, not to the point what Dave Cockrum did, but it was his greatness. But he brought the Fatal Five back, you know, he brought all this stuff going on. I really enjoyed it, and then Adam Hughes left after a while, and somebody else took over, and I stopped reading it again. Alan Davis and Mark Farmer. Mark Farmer wrote two square-bound issues of the Legion. I think it's called Superboy's Legion. But it was like an Elseworlds thing where Superboy didn't come to Earth as a kid. You know, he was found on an asteroid by Brand, the richest man in the universe, the star of the Legion. And he grew up as Superboy. But by this time, superpowers are illegal. And it's the Superboy creates the Legion outside the Earth. And I don't know, Mark Farmer wrote it, Alan Davis drew it, Farmer inked it, and it has the feel of those old stories. And, you know, he kind of retold it and changed things around a bit. But I always loved the Legion and the Cockrum stuff to me, and that's why I bought that back issue. Was that cover was an unpublished cover at the time that they did on a DC fanzine called The Amazing World of DC Comics.
I have some of those, yeah.
I had a few, but that one sold out and you couldn't get it. And every time I said, do you have issue number? Oh, that's the Legion issue. You're never going to find that. Well, I never did.
Yeah, I've never heard of this magazine. It's called Back Issue.
Yeah, it's two Marvels.
It's like the same people as Alter Ego and Kirby Collector and all that.
That is awesome,
stuff.
Though. I'm going to have to look up some.
It's like Bronze Age. So it's from, like, what's Bronze Age? 71 or 72 up or something like that?
I was looking at the 70s. But
yeah.
I found somebody posted it on Facebook because there's a Dave Cockrum appreciation page. And somebody posted it, and I went to the Tomorrow site, and I just ordered it. And I was a little disappointed. I mean, I like the magazine, but I looked through the artwork. They set it up like an internet page where the artwork's almost like thumbnails instead of large pictures. And I bought it because of Dave Cockrum.
Yeah.
You know, but I haven't had a chance to read it. I'm in the middle of reading something else, and I brought it in to show Al.
And I took it.
Yeah, and Al read it. Well, I'm glad. I am glad. I wanted you to read through it.
Yeah, it looks really cool. Just thumbing through it. I mean, the Legion's superhero, basically. Like, that is the definitive superhero comic book because it's just full of...
It's almost like what the X-Men...
tropes.
It's almost like what the X-Men became before the X-Men.
Right, I can see that, too.
Kind of.
Yeah, but it's neat. This is a slick packaging, the back issue magazine that I'm looking at here. I mean, this is great. There's a ton of different articles and just, like, reviews or things about... all about the Legion throughout these couple of decades, and it's, you can just tell it's by
this is
fans
what,
that love it.
This is what a fanzine, this is a really high glossy slick version of what fanzines used to be back in the day. This is basically a fanzine, but they've marketed it as a professional magazine. I mean, it's $9. Most of the fanzines back then had a lot more art and a lot more like just one page illustration, but this is basically what a fanzine is.
Now, Legion of Superheroes and X-Men, when they had the Imperial Guard show up, that was an analog of the Legion of Superheroes.
It's funny, I was going to say something about that, yeah, because there's a huge, looks like almost a centerfold in this back issue magazine that shows like 100 members of the Legion, just a huge, staggering amount. And it immediately reminded me of some of the Cochrane Starjammer.
Well, that's the other joke. The Starjammers was an analog of the Fatal Five, their enemy.
Oh, okay.
And on the Legion of Superheroes, the Fatal Five was one of their main group, and it was five different characters. One of them was half robot, half skeleton, you know, half human. And the Starjammers had a character like that. So it was basically Dave Cochran playing around.
They were still around. I remember when I first started reading comics and I was reading, there was an Uncanny X-Men issue drawn by Jim Lee. The X-Men faced off the Imperial Guard, and there was a 2-page spread of just a huge battle, and you got 20 members in the Imperial Guard. And looking back, you can see they're all kind of avatars of Legion of superhero characters. You've got the one big giant guy who just stands out, and then you've got all the other characters.
Saying all this, the Legion of Superheroes, one of my favorites, I remember it fondly. I love looking, I still think those are Dave Cockrum's best works. Those Legionnaires issues that Chris Sprouse and later Adam Hughes drew are some of my favorite comics. I used to bring them in and Melody would read them. You know, she liked them. But at the same time, there's a real big dorkiness factor to it. You know, I mean, when people complain about comics and saying this and that, I love it. But
that's what I meant by comic booky and a superhero. Yeah.
But the dorkiness is what originally attracted you.
Well,
to the
it's like
book.
B movies. It doesn't mean it's not the Ten Commandments by Cecil B. DeMille, but it's still a great fun movie. And there's a beauty to that. There's something that makes you love that. Even more than blockbuster things.
So sometimes I think the dorkiness was why I bought it, and now when it's the coolness is what makes me not like it as much.
It
so what does
soul.
That say about me? I'm an old school dork.
Oh,
there you go.
True.
You have a split personality.
Or I have a split personality. Oh.
Well, that music by
No, I don't. Yes, I do. No, I don't.
The music by T-Rex.
Yeah.
It was cool, but
it was dorky.
It had a dorkiness to it, but
there's a fine line between cool and dorky. Some people can, the Legion and T-Rex can walk that line to perfection. Others, not so much. That is an interesting concept. The T-Rex and the Legion of Superheroes connection.
Speaking of music, speaking of kind of dorky, I guess I was. There's a band that I really like called Horse the Band. They're pretty heavy. And I was watching some live concerts of them last night, and I had never really seen the guys.
Hmm.
And the keyboard player looks exactly like Napoleon Dynamite. And he's got that funny look on his face. I'm like, wow.
Well, remember that band from the 70s, Sparks?
Yeah, the keyboardist.
The keyboard player who looked like a cross between Charlie Chaplin and Hitler early 70s.
But it was weird because he greased his hair back, which nobody did. That was, and
he just stared.
He looked like a scarecrow, kind of. Yeah, and he had a little pencil mustache, and almost like leered at the audience. He was on a Paul McCartney video.
Paul McCartney played him in a video, actually. There's a Paul McCartney video for the song called Coming Up, and Paul McCartney plays all the rock stars, or Linda.
No, well, the guy from Sparks is in the band. He plays a Paul McCartney.
No, it's somebody imitating him. I swear to God it is. He's not in the band. Paul's imitating all the characters. And Paul and Linda are imitating the characters.
It's not, yeah, Ron, the internet.
Well, the reason I say that was because they were on Saturday Night Live. What happens when Paul McCartney's in Japan, he got busted for carrying marijuana. And then they had Guido Sarducci. And he was outside his house in England trying to get hold of him. And I thought, oh, this is just nonsense. And Guido Sarducci was explaining that he was supposed to be at Paul McCartney's house, and he went, but it was American time. So it was like early in the morning, and he goes, I kind of blew it. He said, I'm going to see if I can get his attention. And I thought, this is just a farce. And he takes a rock and throws it up, breaks the window. And he's like, oh. And I thought, okay, where are they going to go from this? And then Paul McCartney actually comes out of the house in a bathrobe. I said, what are you doing? And he explained why, and then Linda came out in a bathrobe. And I was like, well, why did you break the window? And Father Guido said, well, wait a minute, I know you. You were supposed to come. Where were you? We were waiting for you. Oh, time's different here. Like it was their fault. And they interviewed, and they were talking about they had a video that they were going to play. And this is back when there was no video.
For coming up.
TV. Yeah, for coming up. And they said Paul played all the characters. Belinda kept saying, and also the keyboardist of Sparks. I didn't know who Sparks was at the time. But they kept saying it's Paul playing all the characters, but the keyboardist from Sparks is in it. So, well, evidently Linda McCartney was wrong, and Al knows more. But
yeah, I've seen the video many times.
I can't argue with her now.
No, you can't.
Well, well, listen to us. I didn't know who Sparks was at the time, so maybe it was Linda, but I believed her.
If you don't believe me, Don, it's you gotta believe me.
Al's been right all this time. He's always been.
I'm the rock and roll guy. Unlike
well,
the other
guy.
Well,
I have the definitive answer in the show notes.
but anyway, did you want to talk about that comic book that you brought?
Not really.
Okay.
Oh, well, all right. To be completely honest, so for the past few months, I've only been reading really one book. And I think it's the same thing that Don's been reading for a while, and we're prepping up to actually have an episode-long review of this entire run. So because of that, I haven't read really anything else. Well, I wanted to bring something to the table today. So I brought a book I read probably about 6 months ago, and I don't even know if I remember a lot of it anymore, but it's a trade paperback with the first 5 or 6 issues of a book that came out in the mid-early 2000s called Ex Machina. By Brian K. Vaughan, art and inking by Tony Harris and Tom Feister. And it's great if you know Tony Harris's work. He's done quite a bit. It's kind of photorealistic, and one thing I like about this book is in the back few pages, it actually shows his method. And like a lot of artists and painters before him for comics, like Alex Ross, he'll actually take photographs of his friends or his family in the poses of his panels, and then he'll use that as a photo reference and actually sketch out the images using that. And it's kind of neat because this is kind of packed with a bunch of good goodies in the back of the book. But the premise is a character, and to be honest, I don't remember many of the names because it's been a while, so I feel like I kind of prematurely brought this book here. But the main character was a superhero, and he ended up giving it up and getting into politics, and he becomes the mayor of, I believe it's New York City. And so it's kind of everything. He's dealing with politics, obviously, and what that entails, and then his history and how people feel about him knowing, because the public knows that he was a superhero, and people dealing with his history. And it's fairly compelling. It's Brian K. Vaughan, and he's a great writer. He writes some very original stories. He's got a real ear for dialogue. He's really good at that. I'll give him that. And he's a pretty good pacer of stories. He wrote Why the Last Man, which I fell in love with years ago. He's writing a current book called Saga, which I really like as well. I picked up the first couple issues. So I'd love to say more about this book, but obviously it didn't leave that much of an impression because I don't remember the gist, the better points of it. But art's great. Like I said, the dialogue's really good. The story's not too bad. It flows well enough, and the book goes on, from what I hear, to get much, much better, and it was a fairly long run. This is just the first 5 or 6 issues, but it was Ex Machina, and I enjoyed it.
It's Vertigo. Okay.
It's a Vertigo book, yeah. Right. I actually thought it was an Image book, but you're right, it's Vertigo.
I never read it. I remember hearing Ex Machina all the time.
You guys should read it so we can talk about it a little more in depth, and maybe I'll reread it.
I was going to say.
So that wasn't really... and you can see why I haven't been on the show in a long time. They kicked me off. That's the truth.
Well, no, I've never seen the book. I looked at your copy there, and I got interested in reading it. I've seen Tony Harris's work before. That's some... That's far superior than the stuff I've seen. I thought Ex Machina was an anime. It sounds like a Japanese cartoon.
But, that's Deus Ex Machina, isn't it, that you're thinking of? Deus Ex, maybe.
Really?
There's a book called Deus Ex, right?
I thought it was anime, but looking at it, it's nothing what I thought. But
Ex Machina, I believe, is Latin for the machine.
Yes.
And
is it?
Deus Ex Machina is like the ghost inside of the machine.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
It actually says on the first page or so of that book, it kind of explains the whole concept and the idea of where the title came from. Art's fantastic. It's not my favorite Brian Vaughan stuff, but then, like I said, I really liked Why the Last Man and where he went with it, and I'm loving Saga because Saga is great sci-fi fantasy book where this Ex Machina is a completely different genre. And it's neat that Brian K. Vaughan is a very good writer and he's able to tackle two completely different styles, two different genres.
Yeah, it says here, you'll be treated to a two-fisted blend of superhero action and political debate, Playboy.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've never read any of his work.
This was a pretty celebrated, well-lauded book back in like 05, 06, I believe, is when it came out.
Well, Playboy actually reads comics. Well, I just look at the pictures in both magazines. But hey, anyway, that's besides the point.
Other than that, I really haven't been reading much. My Chris Claremont Uncanny X-Men, I'm continuing going through those. I haven't made too much headway because of my big project that Don and I are working on. Otherwise, that's really it.
Yeah, we'll see in another 15 episodes.
We got some holiday episodes coming up, guys.
The holiday episodes. Stay tuned.
How's Rook doing?
It's pretty good, apparently. I don't know. I haven't talked to him much lately. It was funny, I thought of him earlier when you mentioned Total Recall, because I want to say that him and I went and saw that when it first came out in 1990.
Damn!
But he's doing good. He's just, you know, raising the family and taking care. I talk to him sometimes on my break at work. I'll give him a call, and he'll usually be working, and we'll just kind of BS about things. And he really wants to get back here and, you know, do some
shows. Is he still reading books on a regular basis?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He's probably Yancey Street's best customer. You know, he's always in there, and they... He has such a great rapport with the guys, and I mean, he's really our ear to what's current and what's really going on.
Yeah.
And so that's what I appreciate about, you know, what Rook brings to the table is all the current good books. I don't think any of us read that many current books, and the ones we do generally are kind of off-the-cuff stuff. It's
yes.
not the big two books that we're reading, you know. We don't know what's going on in Avengers this month, where Rook might.
All right. Well, anything else?
No, I guess that's it for me.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me back on the show.
It's your show.
I know. Well, we got taken away, but I'm reclaiming it.
It's not been taken away. It's
well,
your
look,
show.
We want to do a couple shout-outs here. First of all, I just mentioned Yancey Street Comics, and that's a great, great local comic shop from up in the boonies where Rook and I live. And you can find them at yanceystreetcomics.com, I believe, and the street is ST. I'm guessing at that. So if you can't find that, just Google it or go on our site and you can click on the link. We have our sites on bunchofdorks.com. So... go to that site and
click on the Cyclops,
and that will take you to Two Dimension. We have all our shows up there. You can check them out. Don does a really good job of the liner notes and attaching anything that has to do with the shows for further reading. We mentioned the Legion of Superheroes. If you go on our site and find this episode, you'll see images of it. You'll see links to different stuff. You know, whatever we mentioned on this show, you know, you can always read further thanks to, you know, our site, thanks to Don.
We'll be playing the Paul McCartney video on our website.
We'll play the Paul McCartney video.
We can link it. We can link
we'll
it easily.
Link and you, if it's
and you tell
it,
us.
You
tell us.
You can see who was in it.
Well, you know, you tell us who is Don right or I'm right. We'll see who. You be the judge, as they say. Also on Bunch of Dorks is Slow Robot, which
Slow
I'm on.
Slow Robot a Go-Go.
Your B-movie entertainment sent network where we review B-movies all the time. And outside of that hub of entertainment, I have my Destination Nightmare thingy where I do podcasts, I post comics, review movies, and all sorts of good stuff like
we
that.
We need to add like an echo behind you and some lightning in the background when you say Destination Nightmare. Yeah, you like that? That's lo-fi right there. Cause
yeah.
You know I ain't doing anything in post.
No. Well, we may add a laugh track one day, but that's a whole different story. Yeah.
And even though Dallas doesn't do the show any longer, he's still doing his webcomic, The Mighty Blue.
That's right.
You can find it in a number of places. The Mighty Blue Blogspot. Wait, what is it? The Mighty Blue Mighty Blue Comic .blogspot.com.
Right.
You can also go to smackjeeves.com, and which is a community comic book website.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go on smackjeeves.com and just keyword The Mighty Blue, you'll find it. Go to comicfury.com. The Mighty Blue's in there too. I also have a Facebook page.
This guy gets around.
Or you can just click on the icon on the sidebar of the Two Dimension page, which gets you
and
all
Destination Nightmare too. You're on there too, so you can get there from there.
And while we're throwing out a ton of crap at you for you to remember, and I hope you're writing all this down, gentle reader or listener, we're also on iTunes. That's a very important thing.
Yes.
We'd love some reviews. We'd love some stars. You know, just rate us, listen to us, give us some feedback. If you don't like what we're talking about, let us know. Let your voice be heard so we can start talking about
something topics. You want to talk about.
Yeah, something that you want to talk about or you want to hear. You know, join in on the forum. Come on.
All you listeners, and you know who you are, and we know who you are, and we know where you work, write some comments on
Unfortunately,
there.
Unfortunately, 59's last episode is loaded into iTunes.
Why?
Am I going to have to edit this whole thing out?
No, you can leave it in. I don't know why. I apologize for it. 52 wouldn't load. Then the other ones did. But I think we got up to 59, and that's the last episode that goes on iTunes.
I did not know that.
Well, then, clearly, if you're listening to this episode, it's not from iTunes. So now you can go to iTunes and listen to the old episodes and leave some reviews for us.
We will work that technical problem
I'm
out.
Trying. I can't figure it out. I've gotten help.
Al's mean mugging Don right now.
No. Like I said, Promy's looking at it from a bunch of
He said,
I can't find anything. Everything lists the same. I can't find a problem. And that's what he's run into, too. And I said, I don't know what to do.
How dare they?
But, well, like I said, it's just kind of bizarre. 52 wouldn't load. I even had Dallas redo the show.
Have we been comic blocked?
No. It's not. It's not anything like that. It's just something. There's a small problem with the feed, I'm guessing, and iTunes isn't recognizing it, and I can't find the problem.
Okay.
So, anyway.
Don, you got anything else you want to pin?
No, that's it. Just, if you could leave us a review, we'd appreciate it, and thanks for listening.
Don, you got that comic book that you're going to have out this year, right? No?
The Visitor, I've been waiting for that.
The deadline is looming.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no chance. There's no ball chance in hell.
Stanley Cole, he wants it done.
Yeah.
Well, folks, thank you so much for listening, and we really hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed making it. And until next time, take care of yourselves, and...
Read more comics.
He constructed a factory just because he was hungry, just to see how it tasted. Bicycle wheel in a brat's brain. Yeah, he's bad. He's not a First he started on furniture, then he moved on to parking lot. Now he's eating Ansonia, now he's eating Andromeda.